Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
If you ski, I don't need to tell you, things have changed over the last few years. One of the biggest shifts has been the rise of these multi-resort ski passes. You sometimes hear them called mega passes. The biggest ones around here are the Epic and the Icon. And they make it possible, and for a lot of people, affordable to bounce around from resort to resort, not just in Utah, but all over the place. And those passes have helped fuel a surge in popularity at the resorts here. So more skiers, more visitors, but a very different experience on the mountain. It's reshaped not just the business of skiing, but the culture of it. And for some people, the joy of it. This is how Joe Prokop feels about it. Joe is a colleague of ours, and for a very long time now, he's been an Alta guy.
The whole reason I came to Utah was to ski. And for a long time, it was to the point where you could ski on nonstop powder days and have these amazing experiences, these amazing days that stick in the back of your mind. You know, like the time that I got to the top of Gunsight. I was hiking with my friends, and then I looked down there, and it's a powder day where it's up to your armpits, and it was cloudy. The sun broke, the clouds broke, and I look back at my friends, I look back at that powder, and I'm like, see ya. I still remember it, that feeling, that idea of floating, that idea of unbridled joy to this day, that one run. And I've had thousands of days like that. Skiing is my tribe. It's my friends. I know people that I started skiing with who had kids, who those kids have now had kids. I met my wife there, fell in love with my wife. To this day, at Alta, if I don't run into someone coming up and down the stairs to the locker room, I will run into someone in lift line and we will go and ski. I never have to show up, you know, and worry that I'm going to be alone. It's that feeling of camaraderie, but it's also people that have come before me, you know, this continuity. I could draw a direct line through people that I know that go all the way back to when Alta was started. It's a big part of my identity. It was always just there, and it still is always just there, but it's not the same as it was. A lot of it changed when you started having some of those multiple resort passes. For a long time, you got a season pass, you're an Alta skier, you're a snowbird skier, a Brighton, you know, Big Cottonwood solitude skier. But the multiple resort passes are available, so I'm not tied to one mountain. If I decide I want to go to Snowbird this day or Solitude this day, I'm going to go there. And so you don't see that familiarity. You see traverses cut into the hill in places that, dude, where were you going? Or what? You know, there's nothing over there. Why did you go there? You know, it used to be you could just put your beer in a little cache in the snow and no one would bother it. The first time I had my beer stolen, I'm like, something's up here, you know? Something has changed. And a lot of it is the fact that snow is a precious commodity. It's like fresh strawberries. Once it's used up, it's used up. point is that when you have this limited resource and now you have unlimited people wanting to use this resource, it is not going to go well. I don't own the mountain. Anyone can show up. But there are certain aspects of the culture that are definitely real and definitely concrete. It's like rules of the road. And I don't see that with all ICON pass holders. But what happened was, is when we bought a car, one of the things that they offered us to sign the deal was a ICON pass. And I was like, you know what, I'll take it. I'll try it. Ultimately, I only used it for 3 days. And I went up to Washington. And honestly, I broke one of the rules, right? They have a way that they alternate their lifts. I just barged my way in there and literally got chastised by one of the locals at Crystal Mountain for, you know, kind of not knowing how to operate. The problem with the multiple ski resort passes is that you don't commit to one place. You don't learn the culture. And the reason I can have so much fun on any given day at Alta is because I know where the wind blew. I know where the sun shined. I know the lay of the land because I have 30 years of experience learning this mountain. And you're not going to learn the mountain in a weekend. You're not going to learn the culture in a day. And, you know, those days of going back to when I could ultimately ski all day with no one in my way, those days are gone.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the effect of the megapasses on the business and the on-the-ground reality of skiing in Utah, how they changed the way people plan a ski day, who shows up, and how they've changed what it feels like to be on the mountain. We also have to talk about weather, because unpredictable weather is one of the reasons these passes are so appealing and at the same time so disruptive and so full of trade-offs. We're going to start with Sam Weintraub. He's a ski industry observer. He's the founder and CEO of PeakRankings.com. It's a website that reviews and ranks ski resorts around the world. And Weintraub has been writing about how the Epic and the ICON passes have changed skiing. And he told us their impact is hard to overstate.
It's changed the way that you have to plan for your ski trip in almost every level if you are going on a destination ski trip. You can't buy lift tickets the day of unless you are made of money at this point. If you want to actually go on a trip for an affordable rate, you need to get one of these pass products. Because of the way that the industry is now structured, you are now much more incentivized to go without restrictions if you have a pass, and you're not incentivized to go at all if you haven't been proactive and haven't gotten one. So you have fewer casual skiers, and you have skiers and riders who have bought those passes ahead of time being more likely to commit than you would have had in years past. So what that means is we have, I've seen like higher skier numbers, but what I believe is happening is it's not new people getting into the sport. It's more casual people who may have skipped out on a season if the conditions weren't that good, who are now committing beforehand.
Yeah.
So what that means is if they've already bought a $500 Epic local pass or an $1,000 ICON pass, you've already put the money in. And so you're going to go even if things don't look as good.
Maybe we should also explain for those who are maybe vaguely familiar, but not sure exactly what these passes are. Give us a sense of just kind of a primer, how they work.
The way that these passes work, I'm going to break it down in terms of places they access and how you get access to these resorts. So the places they access are often multiple different resorts across almost every major region of North America, and now even Europe, Japan, New Zealand, Australia, and we're even starting to see there's one place in Chile, one place in China, one place in Korea. So like they're starting to offer access to places all around the world.
Yeah.
For Epic and Icon in particular, if you buy like one of their full season long passes, you get access to resorts for at least 5 days, which would be enough for a week long trip. And in some cases it's unlimited.
Yeah.
So theoretically, someone who has one of these passes could just, if they have the means to do it, a lot of money, a lot of time off, or you could live in a place that's close to one of these mountains. And that's key.
Yeah.
You're already probably going to pay off the pass if you ski a week, but you could ski 5 weeks, you could ski 10 weeks, you could ski over 100 days. And this pass product would be totally able to accommodate that.
So it's as you have said in your writing, it's a killer deal. It's kind of incredible.
Absolutely. If you can make it work, then it is an absolutely phenomenal deal.
One of the characteristics of these passes, and I think it helps understand the challenges that ski resorts are going through, is you have to commit to buy the pass before the ski season begins. This is really important. It's kind of a gamble that you're making. Explain this part of it.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So the way that the ski resorts have figured out how to make this work is it's an incredible deal, but you have to commit before the season starts. And so the reason why this is so advantageous to the companies that issue these passes is when you're a ski resort company, traditionally, you're not making any money if you are in the spring, summer, or even early fall.
Yeah.
And by only selling the passes during that downtime, it's completely revolutionized the cash flow of how these companies make money. The fact that they're able to lock people in, they're able to have a much more consistent, much less seasonal cash flow. It still is seasonal, but it's not as seasonal. But the fact that you are getting this killer deal is actually helping the businesses from a, you know, like standpoint that a lot of people don't fully understand unless they have. Well, I was going to say unless they have an MBA. I don't have an MBA, but like, yeah, if you don't have a business background, it's hard to understand just how advantageous what you're doing is for the resorts as well.
Okay, so it makes sense from a business perspective for these resorts to participate in all of this. But let's back up. Help us understand the history of these passes. When did they first take off? I mean, they've been around for about 10 years or so, but you say something happened about 5 years ago that made them really popular. Take us through that story.
So I'll just start very briefly with 2008. That was when Vail launched the Epic Pass. And at the time, it included five resorts, I believe. Vail, Beaver Creek, Heavenly, Keystone, and Breckenridge is the fifth one. Yep. Basically, for all of those resorts, a season pass used to be over $1,000. But what the Epic Pass did was it just took the pass for all those mountains, combined it together, and made the price, I believe it was $599. It was an absolutely insane steal. But the catch, like you alluded to earlier, was you had to buy before the season started. And so the pass became an absolute hit. Because Vail is a public company, we can see their financials. It really, really helped them with seasonal cash flow. And so now they were able to make money over the spring and summer, which helped them invest into more capital improvements. So basically what that meant was they now had more money to put in new lifts, infrastructure improvements like hotels and things like that. And perhaps most importantly, they had money now in order to acquire new ski resorts. Between 2012 and 2019, Vail acquired dozens of resorts. And at the same time, there was this other company, Alterra, that had just formed, 2018. Alterra was a combination of Mammoth Resorts, IntraWest, and Deer Valley. So Deer Valley owned Solitude at the same time. So both Deer Valley and Solitude were formed into this company. And their intention was to build a pass product that could truly compete with Epic. And so this big event that happened was the introduction of the Icon Pass, because it created a world in which the Epic Pass wasn't necessarily the only game in town for this miraculous multi-resort pass strategy anymore. It was now a duopoly. And now it was two companies racing to compete against each other.
So this is the moment of transformation, the competition between these two big, massive companies.
That's right. And within the next 12 months of that happening, Altera bought Crystal and Sugarbush, and the people who were selling those companies, basically, they both said that with the duopoly that was forming with the MegaPass products, they just couldn't compete anymore. They didn't have the resources. And so basically what happened was, even if the resource didn't sell, though, the ones that weren't on the Epic Pass, all of the major ones joined the Icon Pass. And so we were now in a world where every major resort that people would go to was now on one of these passes. And essentially what happened in the wake of that was lift ticket prices started increasing by unconscionable rates. Like, you would see 20% increases year over year.
So this is what you've described as the kind of dark flip side of the story. It's a time when a lift ticket at a local resort is like, it's pretty expensive, and it seems like a really good option for families and people who can't afford those prices to get an Epic or an Icon pass. But the thing is, these ski passes at local ski resorts, just lift ticket passes, went crazy in terms of the price. This is the dark flip side of the story.
Yeah, well, I would say local resorts are actually another story entirely. But if we're talking, like, you know, resorts that are affiliated with Epic and Icon, that is absolutely the case, with only a few exceptions. So, like, the resorts that were owned by Vail, that are owned by Vail, the lift ticket prices have become out of control.
Yeah.
For the ones that are owned directly by Altera and the ones that are owned by many of their partners, including Boeing, Powder, some of the, you know, really well-known ones like Jackson Hole, Telluride, and Aspen, those resorts, it's really, really hard to find lift tickets that go for under $200 during a peak day.
Well, I was looking at one of your pieces, and I don't know which fits into the, you know, Vail section or the Altura section, but I'm looking at the Utah ones, Snow Basin, Snowbird, Deer Valley, Powder Mountain.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all well over $200 for a day lift ticket. Some are nearly $300.
Yeah. I think Park City right now might have a one-day peak lift ticket of around $350. I think the same is true for Deer Valley.
Wow. So how much of that is because of these Epic and Icon passes, the fact that they took hold? How much did that influence that surge in pricing?
I think that is almost the entire reason for it.
Yeah.
I don't think any one of these resorts could sustain themselves off of charging all of their customers that absurd amount of money in order to go. You know, when we're thinking about these lift ticket prices, what the resorts are effectively doing, whether they know it or not, I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to get more and more people to buy the passes because the lift tickets are unaffordable.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you look at this, if you're a skier or rider and you arrive and you realize you have to pay $350 for a lift ticket, you're, you know, oftentimes the way people or companies make you feel hits you more than objectively what they're doing. And the way you feel when you arrive at a resort and you are being forced to pay $350,
yeah,
because you didn't buy your pass ahead of time, your muscle memory will never allow you to do that again.
Right. Yeah.
So then people will start buying the passes.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, one of the reasons why these passes made sense to the industry, outside of the sort of the business part, was one of the key components you write about is weather risk.
Yeah.
I guess this is because the climate is shifting. But talk about this part. The winter season is harder to predict, and that's playing into all of this as well.
So with ski resorts, if you are running a resort and you're dependent on people who buy tickets the day of, you're basically going to lose out on a whole lot of revenue if you have a bad week, month, or especially if you have bad season. Because of the fact that these passes make you commit before early December, you're usually committing before any person who knows what they're talking about has any idea what the weather's really going to be. By making it so that people buy these passes blindly and take weather out of the risk, people, unless it's been an absolutely terrible season the year before, throughout the entire season, will be just buying those passes ahead of time, and they'll sunk the cost, so they'll go even if the conditions are terrible.
Sam Weintraub, he's the founder and CEO of the website peakrankings.com. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're looking at how this new era of ski passes is reshaping skiing in Utah. The Epic Pass, the Icon Pass, they opened the door for more people to come ski here more often, but that surge in popularity may have come faster than many resorts can handle, and locals, anyway, are starting to feel the strain. We have with us the ski industry observer, Sam Weintraub. I want to get to the question of how these passes are changing, or some would say, you know, ruining the experience of skiing. One of the things, for sure, there are bigger crowds, obviously. What you describe is the big changes in on-mountain crowding patterns. So how have the Icon Passes changed in that sense? I'm guessing that that infamous red snake, as we in Utah describe that, you know, line of vehicles headed up Big and Little Cottonwood Canyons to get to the ski resorts, that that's one of the results of all of this. But how is it changing, like, the experience of being on the mountain?
Yeah, I mean, I think things are more crowded. You're sharing the mountain with more people. I think that also you are dealing with a lot more hassles when it comes to getting to the mountain. This is especially the case in like Little Cottonwood Canyon and Big Cottonwood Canyon, where the access road to get to the resort is one of the biggest pain points in actually visiting. You know, like you're oftentimes, if it's a powder day, right, like the going and skiing on a powder day can actually be more annoying than it is fun because of just all of the time you have to wait on the access road to get up there. One way that the resorts have tried to address this is by instituting paid parking reservations. But a lot of people are just really annoyed by that because, you know, it has helped with traffic, but you now have to pay an extra tax that you didn't originally sign up for just in order to get the experience that you used to be able to go and get for free. And it just feels a lot more commercial. It feels like there's so many people who are trying to take advantage of the slopes, and it feels frustrating. I mean, that's the way I would put it. I think, you know, obviously in the canyons, the fact that there are limits on the number of people who could go does help in terms of like making it so the crowding isn't truly horrific. But, you know, resorts like Brighton and Solitude weren't necessarily designed to see even a moderate amount of crowds. And so you have resorts like Solitude where the Summit Express Quad, which provides the only access to the entire upper mountain. And that makes that lift into a huge choke point. And with so many more people on the mountains, these choke points become more noticeable. But then you have a place like Park City, which is the only unlimited ski resort on the Epic Pass in Utah. And it's actually now the only Epic Pass ski resort in Utah. With the road limitations being a lot lower, that resort has just gotten insanely crowded compared to what it was even like 10 years ago. And when you see like crazy lift lines at Park City, you just have people who are looking to use their pass. And Park City also has just a number of factors that make it incredibly attractive to people who are booking a ski vacation. It may not have the most snow compared to Outdoor Snowbird, but it has a true Opry ski town. It's only an hour from an international airport, and it's not at too horrible of an elevation. There are no other ski towns in the United States that have those combinations.
We began our show with the story of a longtime Utah skier who talked about how the experience for skiing for him, and I think this is true for many, many others, is that it's more than just recreation. It's become kind of a, you know, like a part of their identity. It's kind of, in this case, Joe is his name. It's his community. It's kind of like a culture, really. And the coming of these icon and epic passes, he has talked about, changed a lot of that, that it brought in people who, you know, haven't really put in the same time to the experience or have the same kind of reverence for it all. They don't know how to share the terrain or to, you know, interact with other people on the mountain or respect a kind of old school tradition. What do you say about that part to this story?
Well, I mean, I think if you commit to one of these passes, you probably have a lot of money. Whether or not you can ski now has to do with, number one, whether you can afford it, because, you know, buying these passes still costs a lot of money. And number two, it revolves around the fact that the passes now allow you to go everywhere. And I think maybe what Joe is noticing is the fact that these resorts are able to be accessed by people who have access to passes everywhere. I'm not a local to Utah, but I have both the Epic and Icon passes. And so I was able to ski at both Alta and Park City today, because the pass that I used to go to Hunter in New York or, you know, Jiminy Peak in Massachusetts gets me access to Alta and Park City at no extra cost. We're just seeing another part that Joe might be experiencing is several different cultures of people from different areas are all now skiing together because they have unlimited access to all these mountains.
I guess it's just the consequence of what you describe as that kind of benefit to all of this is the fact that it's democratized access to skiing in a way that it hasn't before.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, you're not going to be a Utah local to know what Brighton in Solitude is anymore. Solitude is unlimited on the Icon Pass, and it doesn't even have any holiday blackouts. Like, Icon, here's another thing. Epic and Icon are effectively advertising these resorts by nature of them being on the passes.
What do you think, Sam, what's the ceiling for these prices? And I don't mean the passes, the Icon passes necessarily. I mean, if it costs $300 or almost $300 now to go to certain resorts here in Utah. If, again, if you're not prepared, if you want that sort of spontaneous, let's head up there. Like, what's the ceiling? Is there one? Are they just going to keep going?
Yeah. I actually think we're at the ceiling. I think we're at it. Because so there's one place that, you know, people can look to understand this stuff. That is Vail Resorts Financials. And the reason I say that is Vail Resorts is the only publicly traded ski resort operator in North America right now where their business model is exclusively operating ski resorts. And their pass sales are starting to go down. So in the past, when Vail was raising their prices by absurd amounts, they were still getting more people to buy their passes. So they could raise their lift ticket price from $269 to $299 at Vail. And the Epic Pass volume would still go up. I think the resorts were just trying to kind of poke at what the consumer was able to handle. If the resorts were still able to make more money, even with the prices going up, then the resorts were going to keep raising the prices. But now we're at the point where Vail, and obviously we don't know Alterra's financials, so we don't know whether they're making more money or whether they're selling more passes. But I find it really hard to believe that Vail is going to raise their prices more now that they are losing out on pass sales. So I think these resorts are realizing that what they're doing is not necessarily sustainable. And I actually think we might see some reversal in the other direction based off of what's
you
happening.
You wrote something really interesting that I wanted to mention. You mentioned Sundance, Provo Canyon, for example, that it's a more independent mount. It's not in any of the, you know, mega passes. And you've talked about how they've been getting a kind of an uptick in traffic. I don't know if this year, I mean, they're relative to some of the other places in Utah. They're on the lower end of the altitude spectrum. They can, you know, sometimes it's a challenge for the snow there sometimes. But it does make me wonder if some of these local resorts may want to sort of disconnect entirely and just sort of push themselves as something that's separate. As you said, it might be working for Sundance. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, and I think they can, because there really has become a niche for resorts that don't attract these, you know, out-of-towners. I've been to Sundance because of the nature of my profession, I did not see like people from New York or California going there. The thing that's interesting about Sundance is they're actually still charging pretty hefty amounts for their lift tickets. But, you know, it's not as much as the resorts in the Cottonwoods. Yeah. And their season passes are actually really cheap. These local mountains are doing somewhat similar strategies to Epic and Icon in terms of, like, you should buy like an in-advance season pass and get a good deal on that. But they're not attracting people who are out-of-towners. And that's preserving a much more local vibe.
Sam, when you look at the financial incentives at play here, are these passes, the Epic, the Icon, the others, are they just here to stay? That they've now become a reality for skiing and that people are just going to have to learn to live with this?
Oh my gosh. So I think that highly depends. I think if Vail Resorts crashes, that could change a lot. If Vail continues to not be able to grow their pass sales, if this happened to be a fad and everyone got sick of the Epic Pass, you know.
It's like when everyone bought a Sprinter van and a Peloton during the pandemic, you mean?
Sure. But like, I actually really hope that doesn't happen. Despite what has happened, the side effects, I think there have been some really good benefits to, you know, these mega pass products. Maybe in some ways they've gone too far, but I think in a lot of ways they have brought benefits that I hope stay with industry for the foreseeable future.
That's Sam Weintraub. He's the co-founder and CEO of PeakRankings.com. It's a website that compares ski resorts around the world. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about how the experience of skiing in Utah is changing, or has changed over the last few years with the popularity of these mega passes like the Epic and the Icon. But the other thing that's changed skiing, certainly this year so far, is the weather. Of course, it's not just this year. An unpredictable climate is one of the reasons these passes are so popular in the first place. We spoke this week with Glenn Merrill. He's a hydrologist with the National Weather Service. He tracks snowpack and precipitation and seasonal water conditions for the state. We talked to him before the weather turned this week, and we wanted to know what he made of the weird winter weather so far and how a changing climate might change skiing. Before we got into snowpack numbers and precipitation data, we started with the intuitive experience that people bring with them when they react to the weather, the way most of us, you know, non-scientists, tend to draw conclusions and overreact and panic about the weather.
Since the beginning of the water year, the months of October through December, the weather has been of extremes.
Yeah.
And whenever we have extremes, I think it stands out that much more. I think it creates a topic of conversation more readily. When you have temperatures in the upper 60s a few days before Christmas, right?
Yeah.
And we haven't seen snowfall in the low elevations, especially, you're going to talk about that.
Right.
You know, not only is it noticeable, but it is a significance to focus on when you're setting all-time monthly records for temperature in November and December, like we've experienced this year. That is not normal.
Yeah.
And when things aren't normal, you talk about it and you draw your own conclusions. And obviously, we do not want to be experiencing months of record-breaking temperatures during the winter months when we're trying to build a snowpack.
Yeah.
Because for the state of Utah, 90 to 95% of our water supply on a given year comes from our snowpack and the resultant snowmelt runoff process and capturing in our area reservoirs.
Yeah. We'll get back to snowpack here in a second. Okay, so that sort of conceptual part out of the way, let's talk about how truly weird the weather has seemed so far this winter. Is what we're seeing in November, December different? I think highly anomalous is how you've put it.
Yeah, if you're breaking records for those months, in that case for November and December, it was related to temperature.
Yeah.
That is anomalous. That has not happened in our historical data record, you know, dating back to the late 1800s here in the state of Utah. If we turn the clocks back to October, that was an extreme in a different way. And that was due to precipitation, record-breaking precipitation in the month of October.
Yeah.
So we went from record-breaking precipitation in October to 2 months in a row that were very dry. But the standout item there where they were record-breaking for temperatures.
How record-breaking? Like how, I mean, I think the way you've put it is we shattered the temperature record.
Yeah, yeah. If we look at the month of December, we're talking 3+ degrees of temperature breaking the previous record. And that's a mean temperature for the whole month. We had several days, just to put it in context, you know, we're here in at the Salt Lake Airport. We had high temperatures of 67 degrees right before Christmas with a low temperature of 59, which beat the previous record temperature for the day. So not only were we very warm during the day, but we were very warm at night, and that's what contributed to breaking that monthly temperature record.
When is the last time we've seen something like this? I know it's a record breaker, but when's the last time we had something sort of like it where it was really warm? Can you search back and give us a sense of that?
Well, I'd say combination of the snowfall we've had thus far and the temperatures and the state of the snowpack. You know, we've had years in the recent past. The beginning of 2024 actually was pretty close to where we're at now on a statewide average for snowpack. But this year we've been warmer versus that year, really turning the clocks back. 1976, 1977. That was the year I was born, so obviously I don't remember it as well as recent years. But 76, 77, the ski resorts, not just here in Utah, but across the West, were struggling to open for the holiday season. Many did not until, you know, after the new year.
Yeah.
That was relatively warm, but extremely dry winter. That was the first winter that Western ski resorts, you know, really started to look into investing in snowmaking. Just as an analog, looking at this year and sensibly looking at the struggles of the ski resorts opening for the holiday season, quite similar in my mind, and the data that I do have available to me is quite similar in nature, outside of this year being much, much warmer.
So it's warmer, obviously. But just how bad is it, just in terms of like the water? Because I think some people might be surprised to hear that in some regions of the state, like the high elevations of northern Utah, we're near normal precipitation levels.
Correct.
Or snow water levels, right? And in the upper Cottonwoods, we're slightly above normal. That's going to surprise people.
It will. And, you know, if I wasn't looking at the data every day,
yeah,
it would surprise me too. Just by looking up, you know, from my house every day and just seeing the lack of snowfall, especially in those mid-elevation bands, you know, below 8,000 feet or so. But yeah, when the storms that we have had this year have come with a lot of moisture. They've been very wet.
Mm.
The snow levels have been higher than normal.
Yeah.
Resultant of, you know, the temperatures in a lot of ways. So it is surprising if you're not tracking the data to see that. Just like I've been looking at stream gauges across the state of Utah, measuring the flow in our area creeks, rivers, and streams. We're doing well, comparable to how we think we would be,
yeah,
because it's been so dry and hot. Many areas are near normal flows right now. We have some areas above, some areas below, but that October precipitation really, you know, aided our stream flows. It really aided our groundwater. Our soil moistures are very high. The one thing we're lacking, though, is really building more of an expansive snowpack.
Yeah.
Because it's localized where it's good right now.
Right. So it sounds like what you're saying is – It's not the moisture part that's the problem. We're getting the precipitation. It's like if you look over the course of the last several years, it seems like there's a kind of typical kind of trend. Sometimes it's really wet, like in 2023, you know, we had that record snow year. Sometimes it's drier, but what does seem to be consistently changing is that the temperature is ticking up. And that's the part that gets people worrying if you're looking for good powder days, right? And good skiing and all of those kinds of things. Is that right? It's like it's the precipitation hasn't necessarily been the problem. That comes and goes, but the temperature is consistently headed in one direction. Do I have that right?
So if we look at annual precipitation data for the state of Utah and all across the desert Southwest, dating all the way back to the late 1800s through the present, we go through wet periods. We go through drought periods. Yeah. We go through abundance like we saw in 2023 to prolonged drought periods, which we saw the years leading up to it. There is not a strong signal in the data for either a net increase or decrease in precipitation over that time scale. That signal has not shown or really shown itself one way or another as of yet.
Right.
If we look at temperature data, again, for the same time scale, and we're talking, 130, 40 years here, right? Beginning in the mid-1970s, in the state of Utah and across the desert Southwest, we've seen a notable increase in temperature trends on an annual basis. So over the last 50 or so years, you know, we've seen temperatures, if you draw like an average line in annual temperatures over the last 50 years, creeping up in a consistent basis. And every year is going to be different. 2023, not only was it record-breaking for snowfall and precipitation, but think how much low-elevation snow we had and mid-elevation snow.
Right.
It was persistence of a pattern. This year, we're seeing persistence of a pattern with our warm temperatures, and then more infrequent but more intense precipitation events in our mountain areas, specifically. So again, every year's different. There's some signals, there's some knowns, and that's what I try to key in on. It's there's a known with the temperatures and warming over time, but there's not a strong signal in precipitation. But those the temperatures, whatever mode they're in, has a direct result on what kind of precipitation you get.
One of the things we've been talking about for this show is the effect of these mega ski passes like the Icon and the Epic passes on the, you know, on the experience of skiing. And one of the things that is driving the popularity of those passes is the unpredictability of good quality snow. People want options to go where the snow is because you can't always count on it. And I know this is probably sort of a longer conversation, but what does all of this mean for the ski industry here in Utah? Some people will be, some years, I guess, it will be wetter than others. But for sure, we know the temperature is going up. And that says something about the quality of the snow for skiers, you know, like for powder, for our, you know, proud designation calling ourselves the greatest snow on earth. It sounds like there's a good chance that could change. I don't know. What do you think about that?
You know, that's really challenging for me to say. Again, you already stated it. Just a couple years ago, record-breaking winter, daily powder skiing, essentially.
Yeah, right.
It was just an amazing year in so many different ways, right? If you look at year to year to year, and the weather from year to year to year is constantly changing, you go through, again, wet years with great skiing with a ton of low elevation snow just as recently as 2023 to this year, which is the complete different extreme.
Yep.
The way I look at it, And this isn't just with skiing, but it's for water supply, conservation. It's, we need to kind of have a grasp of where those goalposts are still. And it's not very often that within 2 or 3 years, you're essentially seeing those goalposts. But that's a good indicator of what we can expect from one extreme to the other. And still, we don't even know where this winter is going to go as of yet.
Well, let me then finally ask you about the ideas you have about where this all might be headed. We just started January. We're at the beginning of winter, basically. So it sounds like from what you were talking about earlier, you think it's just too early to come to any conclusions about how bad this is going to be. In other words, it's too early to freak out.
Again, it's a marathon and not a sprint.
Yeah.
Certainly there are concerns. Looking at everything objectively still, as best as we can. Yeah. The way that I foresee things, and us here at the National Weather Service and the Climate Prediction Center, for the local area of the state of Utah, we're going to get Valley Snow tomorrow, which is notable. Yeah. Unfortunately, after that, we're going into another, you know, persistent period of high pressure and dry conditions for the next 7 to 10 days. Then it looks like we start breaking that down a bit end of the month. So in the very near term, things aren't going to be improving much. But several climate models, and, you know, this is tracking them, you know, since September. The way it looks for February and especially March for central and northern Utah, especially northern Utah, it looks like we're going to get, you know, much more active than we've been. The tables are tipped more towards an above normal precipitation period for the months of, you know, February and especially March. How much above? We don't know.
Yeah.
Could it be below? Yes. But the tables are tipped for above normal precipitation. That would be good.
So I guess what you're saying is, with all the caveats you mentioned, there's hope for people, right?
There's a lot of unknowns still.
Yeah.
And, you know, I am a glass half full type of person. Again, if we look at the precipitation that we've received since the beginning of the water year, if we look at our stream flows, if we look at our soil moisture conditions, many areas of the state are doing okay. One of the things that we'll be looking at more and more, and this is a kind of a feedback loop from last year too, is just how dry southern Utah and their winter season was last year. Mm-hmm. Lack of snowpack. They essentially didn't even have a runoff.
Yeah.
Because the snowpack was so bad. This year, the weather patterns again look to favor the north. We've been talking a lot about the north. But southern Utah, the probabilities of them experiencing above normal precipitation and, you know, boosting their snowpack, again, the savings account, you know, is not looking that great for them, you know, generally, especially like I-70 South. But again, they have a lot more stored moisture in their soils this year than they did last year.
Yeah.
Because of that record-breaking October precipitation. So, it, you know, there are just so many variables that need to be followed and tracked and kind of put into the blender, Doug, right? To come out with like notables for where, you know, the current state of things are.
Right. And that sounds like such an answer from such a scientist. but to the question of hope.
Thank you.
But to the question of hope, come on. What you're saying is, yeah, look, there are a lot of variables. I already mentioned the caveats, but what you're saying is it for at least people in the north, maybe we put it that way, it looks like it might be okay. Let's just wait and see, I guess.
That's the bottom line.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, there are a lot of concerns from how the winter has started.
Right.
And there are a lot of unknowns in how it's going to end. And as we get into February, and especially March, we're going to have a much better grasp on the state of things and where we're looking as we, you know, move forward through the spring runoff season and into the warm season once again.
Glenn Merrill, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Glenn Merrill, he's a senior service hydrologist with the National Weather Service. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover with the help of Katrina Cano. Our intern is Aiden Oneida. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.